You are listening to WPVM LP 103.7 in Asheville, North Carolina. And globally at WPVMFM.org.
Well, howdy, buckaroos and buckarettes.
Here's your Radio Asheville weather report. Scattered showers and thunderstorms later this afternoon. Mostly sunny skies, a high near 88. For tonight, a chance of scattered showers and thunderstorms. Patchy fog developing toward daybreak, a low around 66. More showers and thunderstorms on Friday with a high of 85. Showers and storms for Friday night with a low around 64. I'm Johnny Cottle on Radio Asheville 103.7.
Welcome to Twice 5 Miles Radio, fertile ground for conversations worth listening to and remembering. I'm your host, James Nave. Last week, my guest was Kim Lane. Kim's a poet, a radio host, an author, a teacher, and she's been in the poetry slam and spoken word community for many, many years. Last week, Kim was a guest on Twice 5 Miles Radio. We talked about her engagement with community radio and how she loves doing her show, and our conversation meandered as conversations tend to do. Our conversation was so good last week, and we covered so much, I invited her to come back again this week. Last week, Kim and I talked a great deal about what it means to be involved in community radio. In this show, Kim and I are going to explore what it meant to us to be involved in the early days of the poetry slam spoken word movement in Asheville and nationally. Kim was a member of the Asheville Poetry Slam team that went to Ann Arbor, Michigan for the National Poetry Slam Championships in 1995. And guess what? They won. Kim played a big role in that win. So what we're going to do today is to talk about those experiences way back when. And Kim begins by reflecting on her relationship with the team members she had during the 1995 rehearsal period prior to the Poetry Slam Championships, which were held, as I said, in Ann Arbor, Michigan in August of 1995. I was there, so I watched Kim win the game. It was great fun. So here's Kim Lane. Let's hear what she has to say.
From my perspective, at the time, when I first met, and I put this in quotes, Poetry Slam people, I was a fairly recent graduate of UNCG, the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, had my bachelor's, and you could not have met someone who was more burned out of school. As we were talking in our previous conversation, that lifetime of perfectionism that I instilled upon myself, I burned myself out. Nobody did that. And yet, so I didn't want to do academics. And honestly, I really didn't even want a sort of respectable college graduate job. I wanted to wait tables. I ended up like bartending and cocktail waitressing, and I was a lifeguard. I was just so burned out of thinking. And yet my creative itch went unscratched. And also at this time in the early 90s, like early 90s, if you found Poetry Slam, it's probably because you accidentally stumbled upon it or you knew someone who was involved with it. There was no central organization. I would argue there was little organization. Then that's what made it wonderful. I first found the one in Winston-Salem. I was living with a friend in Greensboro, and I saw it in the weekly free paper. I was just flipping through saying, oh, what's going on? And I remember my girlfriend and I, we saw this thing and we were like, well, that sounds fun. And she said, you write poetry, don't you? I'm like, yeah. So I took my little notebook and I did the open mic part of it because that seemed safe. And it was fine. It wasn't terribly good. I was just another person on stage, but I was already hooked. Steve Wisniewski was in charge of it at the time. We had X-Scene. We had, gosh, I'm trying to remember. Oh, Marissa Meltdown. And forgive me if I forget her last name, but she ended up being a reporter for Voice of America, NPR, and other folks. And then within a couple of months, I thought, this is fun. I like these people. This is my kind of competition. And then I started just driving to Asheville because the Asheville team, someone from the Asheville team had come to visit Winston-Salem. And I met Pat and Danny. And when you first meet them in person, if you are a girl who grew up in Black Mountain, North Carolina, you had college, but you didn't have a whole lot of life experience. Meeting Danny Solis and Pat Storm kind of blows the roof off your mind. I mean, you got a picture. I'm about 6 feet tall. So physically, I suppose I'm a little imposing to some people. But if you've met Pat and Danny, they were both shorter than me and so much more imposing. But in the most wonderful ways, they were like planets. They had a magnetic field that just drew you in. And for all of their bravado on stage and for all of their talent on stage, you just got sucked right in. And also, I think they were seeking to mentor other people. I know Danny was. And I think Pat, during his good moments, was also, he enjoyed being a big brother. And that's exactly what these guys turned into for me. Forget the poetry stuff. They were the big brothers I never had and then continued to have until both of their passing. But that was my very first impression of it. It was this decentralized magnetic force drawing in. I mean this in the best way, kind of these misfit toys of the arts world. You know, we weren't academic poets. We were people who enjoyed performing, but I didn't know a lot of theater people. Like, I'm not a theater person. We were just people drawn together by this odd desire and drive to share our most personal thoughts with each other in a competition, which makes me laugh.
You are describing the magnetism of Danny Solis and Pat Storm and many of the other poets that you and I both knew shared that magnetism. We'll call it that. You were drawn to this. You were hooked, you said. I was hooked right away. For people listening to this and hearing this reference to the Poetry Slam for the first time, you and I have been around this movement for 30 years. To us, it's commonplace. All the references are intact. I can refer to Danny and Pat, and you can bounce it back and forth, and I know exactly what you mean. For somebody who's listening, and maybe they are leaning a bit into the poetry idea, or they don't quite know what you mean by poetry slam, maybe give us a little context. And I'll start by giving a context to you that I realized a while back. When people say poetry slam, and when Mark Smith and the group in Chicago invented the idea or started to develop the idea in the early 80s, the way I understand it, the slam was a reference to the grand slam in baseball. When you knock the ball out of the park, it's the top of the bottom of the ninth, three strikes, you know, got one more swing and you hit it out of the park, a bit like Casey at the bat. And when you hit that ball out of the park and it goes over the fence and you drive the runs in and your team wins the World Series, Chicago Cubs wins the World Series, there's a roar that comes up from the crowd. So from what I understand, the Poetry Slam is framed around the idea of, can you put yourself so present in a poem, in a performance, in your existence on the stage, that when you do hit the poem out of the park, the audience responds the same way they would if you'd hit a grand slam?
Yes. And also this, you nailed it when you said that the thing that drew me and hooked me in Poetry Slam was that I mentioned earlier, I am not and never really have been a theater person. Mm-hmm. I've tried theater and I have to tell you, I did not enjoy it. I don't really enjoy being a consumer of theater all that much either. Like, I enjoy Hamilton and I've enjoyed a handful of musicals and live theater performances here and there. But here was the difference in Poetry Slam for me. is there is absolutely no barrier between me and the performer. That was it. I have never enjoyed playing someone else. I'm bad at that. I'm really good at being me at whatever point I am in my life, however flawed that person was. And the cool thing about Poetry Slam is that people showed up exactly as who they were at that time in their life, however deeply flawed they were or wildly successful they were. I'm thinking of Taylor Motley, always portrayed himself as wildly successful. I don't remember Taylor Motley as doing a lot of poetry about what a flawed person he was. But everyone else laid themselves bare. And that was something I was also bad at in the beginning, was that I and most people of my generation, I'm Gen X, we were told, you don't talk about what goes on in this house outside of the house. Like, you don't air your dirty laundry. That's really a generational thing. We didn't seek out therapeutic or counseling support. In fact, we're restricted from doing so sometimes. And in some ways, Poetry Slam was very cathartic for a lot of people. You're getting on a stage and in a well-crafted way, you presented these parts of yourself, both the joy and the areas of growth and everything in between. You told other people's stories. Some people did great narrative poems. Some people told the story from 10,000 feet. Some people told the story from inside. And that's what I loved about it, is it didn't seem like a construct like theater did. And personally, for me, just theater wasn't, just not my thing. I think of Glenys Redman. You know, Glenys was someone who, when I saw her, and of course, when I met Patricia Smith, and these people, just no barriers. Here I am. I think of Glenys when she celebrated herself, who used to run track. Remember how she used to do those poems about how she would sprint and how fast she was. And I would look at these women and say, I want to be like that when I grow up. I want to be as joyful. And Glenys was not looking at that poem in a golden years kind of way, like, oh, I wish I could still run this way at the age of 33 years old. No, she was simply celebrating that self. And then she was building a bridge to her new self, which was at that time the daughter of young twins. And that for me was just transformative.
Yeah, I remember Glenys showing up at the Green Door in Asheville and walking in and standing on the stage and dazzling all of us. We all thought we were really, really good at what we did. And when Glenys stepped up there, it was like, oh my gosh. Well, mm-hmm. We have something to aspire to. I want you now to go deeper into describing the environment that you remember. What did it look like? How was it laid out? How did the Poetry Slam work? What were the challenges you had in terms of getting into it? Did you find yourself satisfied with the work you did? You ended up succeeding very well in it. How did that all play out? And again, this is the story for the people who maybe haven't had an experience in an open mic, spoken word club or bar or other kind of environment.
Right. Okay, let's look at it overall. First of all, it was so welcoming. It was welcoming to people of all backgrounds, races, genders. Even though I had gone to what you might call an arts, UNCG is largely known, was at the time like the arts school of the North Carolina system. But at the same time, I had not really met and interacted with people on the gender spectrum. And so Poetry Slam was my first encounter with people of different genders, people exploring their gender, people really out with their sexuality. And so that was good for me. And it was good for me to recognize how to be the best kind of human. And so that was the first thing. The Poetry Slam welcomed me, who I had one thing going for me, maybe two, when I first came in. I had I had areas of talent in being a natural performer, I guess, or speaker, and I'm a decent writer. However, I was not good at poetry slam at first. And that's where the welcoming came in. You came in, you were told the rules. There was always a sign-up table. Do you want to do open mic or do you want to slam? And for a while I did open mic because I knew I wasn't ready to slam. When it came time to slam, you know, I didn't win right away. I think people like you recognized, oh, there's some talent that can be developed in this young woman. I'm going to seek her out and mentor her. And that's exactly what happened. I don't think I came in and just blew the roof off the place and everyone was like, well, there's a winner right there. No, I needed talent development. And that's what slam did. I got to present what I had to present. And then I was gently and kindly mentored. I was shown through example and then told in the aftermath, this is what you did. And here's how you can grow as a performer. And within months, I was winning slams. So that was the power of that. That was the power of the welcome. Alan Wolf facilitated all of this. You ask what it looked like. So for us, and we're going to focus on Asheville because we're celebrating that, I think, a lot. Alan Wolf was the one who curated, put this together, and his partner at the time and now wife, Ginger. You walked into the green door, which was down the dark alley in Asheville, totally safe. You walk in, it was a green door, and it was the bottom floor of, you know, an old downtown building. Sometimes it was full, and sometimes there was, you know, 5 or 10 people there. It just depended. You signed up, there was a bar at the other end. You got yourself something to drink. You sat down. There was a very long stage. It was a wide room. It was kind of a hard room to play because there was so much room on the stage that you didn't know how to take up a small bit of it and concentrate your energy. Alan was the host. He came up with the saying, the points are not the point. The point is poetry. And that was also very instructive for me. And he made clear that everyone was welcome, even though sometimes people would come up and say genuinely shocking or eyebrow raising things. He always neutralized the energy. After every poet, he would neutralize the energy, make that person feel good for their contribution, and then clear the air for the next person to come in. He didn't play favorites. He was also a great writer in his own right, but he did not compete. He was there for everyone else. He was there to put together that show and to lead our team and to do the fundraising. He was very gracious. What a great leader we had in him. There could have been no better.
Alan was certainly a master MC, and you know, he's still on the stage and he's still as masterful, of course, much more so now than he was then. Yeah. And like so many people in the Poetry Slam, he went on to become a Candlewick Press young adult author. Yep. And Candlewick Press is the most prominent young adult press in the country. And to be at the top of the Candlewick Press heap, which Alan is, he does sit there with at least 15 or 20 books published by way of Candlewick Press and other publications as well, including his book, The Watch That Ends the Night, about the mm-hmm. Titanic, being named as one of the top 50 young adult books ever written in American literature. So Alan went on from his mastery of the Poetry Slam into the world of literature and continues a very vital career going yeah. all along the way. And tell me more about how you experience the development that you worked with as you moved into the Poetry Slam and into spoken word. And one of my criticisms of the Poetry Slam, and I'd like for you to speak to this, is that it sometimes narrows itself down to a certain formula. And the critique I have of it is
when you are good at it, you are really, really good at it. People who don't have that same inclination to, you know, knock the ball out of the park on the stage come to these shows, they see it and they might feel like, well, I can't do that. So therefore I am not able to participate in this. And in some ways I'm saying that because I had that experience. I've never been inclined to be like that powerful, monstrous poet on the stage that drives the point home with revolution, justice, and desire. I'm more of a storyteller. So I did participate in the Poetry Slam, but I never felt good about it because I could never appeal to the judges. My scores were okay, but never over the top. So reflect on that a bit. What's going on with you, or what went on with you?
I was successful in Poetry Slam for reasons that had a little bit to do with what I did, and that mostly had to do with the team I was on, the mentoring that I received, the everything that we did together. I think the Poetry Slam then and now is a really good reflection of life. Look at what's popular now. And I hate to say it, it's a thing that gets people's attention, whether that's good or bad. There are a lot of great, and when I say great, I mean capital G, great poets who have come out of the Poetry Slam. Patricia Smith is one of them. Gail Danley is another person. Danny Solis was a great poet, a great writer. There were also great poets within the Poetry Slam that Slam didn't recognize. And the first person who pops to my mind is Laura Moran. Laura is, I think, one of the greatest living poets I know. I love listening to her. I got to see her a couple of years ago and hear her, and I remembered what a gift she is to poetry. But she's not a look at me kind of gal, because she is so secure in herself and so confident in her own storytelling and writing. She doesn't need that to amplify her poetry. And so I think it's really a simple answer, Jim. It's what got people's attention. And I think I was lucky in that I got some people's attention with what I was writing and how I was developed, and then how our team came together. Our team was something that I had never seen before. And I got to be honest, I've never seen since. What an amalgam of people we were, and what an interesting form of energy we conveyed on the stage. Our team and that 1995 National Poetry Slam was what got Paul Devlin's attention. It was that. It was the competition between our team, kind of that underdog story, Asheville beating New York and Portland and Cleveland. That got Paul Devlin's attention. And that 1995 Slam was what made him want to do the film for 1996. And of course, all the things he had witnessed in New York, because he was a regular at the New Yorican Poets Cafe. But he saw that and he was like, this is a good story. I'm doing this.
So just a little background for people who are listening, and I'll give this background, and I want you to be thinking about how you can tell us the story of that Asheville Poetry Slam team. So for those of you who are listening to this and you've heard the term Poetry Slam for the first time on this show, and you're thinking, well, what is that? Kim has mentioned some competition. What does competition mean? Are they out there in the field running a race? Is this a card game? How do you judge poetry? So here's the quick overview. A poetry slam was invented by Mark Smith in Chicago with a group of collaborators around him. It was in the early 80s, and he realized that one of the ways to get attention from the audience was to create an environment where the audience could participate.
Right.
He concluded participation would be judging. So, so the idea with a poetry slam is you pick five judges from the audience and you ask those five judges, preferably people that have never been to a poetry slam before, maybe even don't any, even have any literary background, to judge the poem 0 to 10, like a diving match with decimal points. You drop the high score, you drop the low score, you keep the middle three scores, add them up, and they land somewhere between 0 and 30. And whoever has the highest score at the end of the rounds, the evening, they win the poetry slam. Back in the day, you won $10 or something. I think now today, sometimes you have $10,000 slams. And I've seen some of those floating around. So the range is greater. The momentum is more. Poetry slam is spread all over the world. But the core of it is judges in the audience, poems, poets on the stage, MC runs the show. The point is to allow the audience to participate. It's about the audience as much as it is about the poets, maybe even more so. So that's the environment for the poetry slam. Now, one other thing to know before Kim dives in here and tells all about how she became deeply involved in it on a national level. For years, what made the poetry slam work for so many people all over the country, the National Poetry Slam Championships, which started in the early 90s and between San Francisco and Chicago, and maybe there was Boston involved in it. And it started with three teams in the beginning, and then it grew to 20 and 27. And so by the time 1995 rolled around, there were numerous teams competing on a very large scale. And the competition was fierce, sometimes 50 teams, 60. Towards the very end of the National Poetry Slam Championships, which now have faded. They no longer happen anymore. The last one was in Denver, Colorado in 2015, 16, or 17. And now that they're no more. But during that time, big stage, final championship, 1,000 people, 2,000 people in an auditorium, it was basically a rock concert. So, Kim, you entered the green door, read at the open mic, learned how to slam poetry, ended up getting on the Asheville Poetry Slam team. I was on that slam team, and I competed in 1994 when we had the National Poetry Slam Championships in Asheville, and we were fourth then, I think. Yes. And Danny Solis was on the team with me, but Pat Storm was not. So in 1995, that momentum continued on, and you picked it up by qualifying for the team. So what happened to you? The little 20-year-old graduate student suddenly steps on the stage in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And I was there that night. I drove actually from New York to Ann Arbor to watch that show. And I got there for the finals. That was all I saw. And I saw Asheville win. So I did witness it. Tell us about it.
Well, it starts in Asheville. When before we even qualified for the team, it started because Danny Solis got me ready to compete to be on the team. I did not do that on my own, and I did not do that in isolation. Had I been left to my own devices, someone else would have been on the team. But Danny saw whatever he saw, and he was largely responsible for mentoring me into not so much the writing. He liked the writing, and Danny helped me to organize my poetry and to convey my performances in a way that learned how to respond to the poets who went before me. So in a poetry slam, one thing that Danny also conveyed to me, and you did too, as well as Bob Falls, is a poetry slam is a show, and everything that you do contributes to a good show. And that was also something that I kept in mind. If you're the first person who takes the stage, you need to create a certain kind of energy. You probably don't want to start with what Danny would call the C-list pieces, which were specialty pieces or more in-depth pieces. You really want to start with an A-list piece, something that's going to grab the audience by the throat and say, you're here for a show. And then from there, he taught me how to respond to the poet who went before me. So let's say that I am going after Pat Storm, who, you got a picture. He was about 5'9", brawny, covered in tattoos, long red hair. He looked like a, he looked like the Viking who was going to build your house. You know, that's what he looked like. And that was his last name was Nordstrom, which is where we got the word name Pat Storm. So if you're following him and you're me, you're a tall, skinny, long red hair, white girl, you got to follow, you got to break that energy and you have to follow it with something different. And I had to be me because that was not Pat, and you had to change the energy. And I would always follow him with another dead American poetess. And it would be the story of how when I die, you know, and then the grand eulogy that follows. And that was a good piece to follow him. So that was how I got on the team, is because I was mentored on how to get onto the team. Then here I am on the team. And for us to win, like Danny was so hungry to win. And it's because he had won before. He had been on a winning Boston team. He had worked with Ray McNeese, you know, the legend out of Cleveland. So Danny knew what it was like to win, and he knew what it was like to lose. And to know anything about Danny is to know that he does not like to lose. And if he is with other people, you're going to win. And so I was then in boot camp. I would drive from Winston-Salem to Asheville every single weekend. And this is when I'm working a day job and sometimes a second job as well. So I'm driving to Asheville every weekend and we are rehearsing. And this is where we need to talk about something that was also a reality of SLAM. And I think any arts community, and that's maybe some of the not so nice stuff. And that is one of the reasons I think I was able to be successful and have a long career in poetry still to this day is because by and large, I've mostly been a sober person. Now, of course, I've enjoyed drink, you know, now and again, I've enjoyed some nights where I had a little bit too much to drink, but by and large, I have been the designated driver and I've been the person who kind of watches what I do. And that's just kind of my nature. That's what I prefer to do. Some of these weekends were hard because Danny and Pat in particular made different decisions. And some of the weekends, if they were a little too alcohol soaked, were hard because we had to navigate that. There was no diagnostic stuff going on. There were some weekends where we had too much to drink and there were some weekends when they didn't. And there were a few times when, you know, the old Barley's Brew Pub, are they still there in Asheville? Well, the number of times that, say, Lee Lancaster, also a person who's largely sober at the time, and you know if they are still, but the number of times that we had to kind of navigate Pat and Danny out of bars because things got uncomfortable or maybe less than safe for everyone involved, that was part of it too. And that was hard. When we would do showcase performances, sometimes that would happen as well. We would go travel to another place to do a showcase of our team, Southern Regionals. That was hard. But it also weirdly built my resilience and really helped me to focus on what was important. Alan was a good example of this, that even though he was a little bit older than me, so he was kind of like an older brother as well, he modeled that sort of responsible sobriety, but still having a drink now and then kind of ethic. And I really watched him. I watched Lee Lancaster. I watched Ginger. And I watched how they navigated the guys so that I could also appropriately navigate the guys. Who I will also say this, the guys were always appropriate with me. Let's not forget Ted Vaca. So we had Ted Vaca, we had Pat Storm, we had Danny Solis, who always treated me with respect, really did treat me like a little sister. And that's the we're annoyed with you part as well. But that was fine. And so that's what it was like. I was never abused in any ways by them. And I think that's one reason why we were successful. We treated ourselves like a little family. And Danny taught us how to win.
Now, tell me more about the rehearsal process. And the reason I'm asking, most people who see folks on stage feeling comfortable think, oh, they were just born that way, and they walk out there and it's no big deal.
Nope.
There's a lot that goes on behind the scenes in order to be able to walk out on stage and just stand there and let people look at you. What was the rehearsal process like? How did it evolve for you? What did it teach you that you still know now?
It taught me, this sounds so cliche, I can't believe I'm saying it out loud, but it taught me how to believe in what I was saying. That was it. I knew that I was a good writer. I knew that I had potential to be a good performer. But I will say, I am not a natural performer. I have terrific performance anxiety, which, interestingly, I was only able to name when I had my daughter, and she has performance anxiety. I was like, okay, now I understand. So our best performances, the most memorable ones, were on the stoop of where Ted and Laura lived. We would sit out on the stoop, and we would rehearse just out on the sidewalk. Their neighbors were very accepting and understanding of this. It was in that Montford area of Asheville, and that's where we rehearsed. We would go round robin. We would rehearse pieces over and over. It was like sports. It really was. It was, I've not done enough theater to know what theater's really like, but it was just a crap ton of rehearsal. It was get up, eat good food. I remember Danny was always like, you have to stay fed. You have to take good care of yourself. So I did. I ate good food. I did my workouts, and we rehearsed. We rehearsed day into the night. We also would book performances so that we could show people what we were doing. And that gave us an opportunity to see how do pieces play off of each other. We found, for example, that it was usually not a good idea for Pat to follow me or me to follow Pat, because we looked kind of alike. We, you know, both redheads. We didn't have same energy, but like these two white redheads, it just didn't work. And so we found it was usually better if I followed Danny or if Danny followed me. It was things like that that we learned. And then, so this is the story I know that you and Danny always used to tell. Let's talk about how we won. And we won through strategy. I would argue we didn't win through superior poetry. We won because we were the first people who developed the real group piece. We put together a piece of jazz. And it was multi-voices. It involved some singing. I did a little bit of song in there. And we placed it strategically in the competition. In addition to that, so the poetry slam is very clear, no props, no background music, you know, instrumentation. But you can use what's on stage. So during the national competition, I remember I did a poem about being a member of Generation X. And so I don't remember what order I was. I think I was third. I know I wasn't last. Our group piece was last. So before I was called out to the stage, I was standing behind the curtain, and Danny came up really at the last minute. He was like, we're going to open the curtain for you so that you're, instead of just walking from the side, as most poets did, the guys gave me a grand entrance. And visually, I suppose that was different, and it was striking to the audience, because here's what it looked like. It was a big red curtain. And when they called out my name, there was a pause. And Danny, Pat, and Ted were on either side of the curtains, and the curtains split open in the back of the stage. And I come walking up from back center stage. I'm 6 feet tall. I have giant red hair about down to my waist, and I'm wearing all black. And I have very light skin. I take the mic, I take a pause, as Danny always taught me to do, and I went into my poem. And then I left the stage the same way I came out. And after that, we did our group piece, which really did kind of blow the roof off the place. That was unlike any group piece anyone had ever seen. And Paul Devlin still talked about it. And that group piece was what put us over. It put us over, and because we were not ahead the whole competition. It was going back and forth between us, Cleveland, and Portland. And that group piece happened and we won. That was that.
Those group pieces, Danny Solis, and I have to say Danny is no longer with us on Earth. Sadly, Danny departed, but he was a living legend, and now he's a passed on legend, but still the legend is very, very much alive. One thing we haven't mentioned, when I was involved with the poetry activities in Asheville, one of my creative collaborators, Bob Falls, and I had developed a business called Poetry Alive, and we were performing poems for school students around the country. I believe you worked for Poetry Alive for a while.
I did.
You're live, so you know what that is. And for people who are wondering what that means, we were memorizing poems from the school textbook, performing them as theater for school students. These were not poems that we wrote. These were classics like The Road Not Taken by Robert Frost, I'm Nobody by Emily Dickinson, The Cremation of Sam McGee by Robert Service, Ernest Lawrence Thayer's Casey at the Bat, and on it goes, poems mm-hmm. that were in the school textbook. The Hollow Men was one of those poems that we performed. That was a T.S. Eliot poem, mostly appeared in 11th, 12th grade shows. And early in those days, Danny was also working with Poetry Alive as well. We started to script those poems on stage because we got bored with one person performing them. So the Hollow Men, we are the Hollow Men. The stuffed men leaning together, headpiece filled with straw. Alas, our dry voices when we whisper together are quiet and meaningless as when the dry grass or rats feed over broken glass in our cellar. So the voices would go back and forth, back and forth. And then in 1994, when Danny was on our Asheville team, we experimented with those group pieces. Mm-hmm. And we discovered that they got a lot of attention and nobody had seen it. And Danny was really driving that group piece train. So by the time he arrived hungry to win, because he had been on the 94 team that lost, mm-hmm. he was on the 95 team that was headed toward the win. He brought all of that experience with the group piece. And that's how it arrived with you and Ted and Pat and Danny. And so by the time you all stood on that stage and used the group piece to win, Danny had brought all of his experience and he created what may be the marker that launched all the group pieces throughout the Poetry Slam from that point on. I don't know for sure, but I think that may have been the spot. And then in 1996, Paul Devlin did show up in Portland and did mm-hmm. film the Portland Nationals, which became Slam Nation, which to this day is the only documentary film that captures the Poetry Slam in those early days. And you can still pick it up. You can find it online, even on HBO, actually, at some point, maybe still.
Yeah, well, if you want to watch it, and I think it's fair to give him a little endorsement, go to pauldevlin.com. And Paul, I am sure, would be happy to send someone an educational copy, because that's the other thing. He has educational copies of that DVD or whatever media you wish to have, if you want to show that in the early days of Slam. But yeah, let's talk about Bob Falls and Rodney as well. So they hired me for Poetry Alive when I finally, at long last, turned 25, because you can't rent a car in this country if you're under the age of 25. And I so wanted to work with Poetry Alive. So for all of that time that I did not want to do a real job, although I did work, please know I've always worked hard and, you know, paid my bills and more. Working with Poetry Alive was a real pleasure. And Poetry Alive, thank you, Bob Falls, thank you, Rodney, is why I became a teacher. When I first went to work with Poetry Alive, I was always paired with the most handsome young African-American men. And the reason it was explained to all of us is because visually and culturally, and I guess synergistically, that was a combination that really worked on stage. And I got to tell you, I never had a stinker as a partner. My longest partner was Jeff Jones. And I don't know what's become of him, but he was someone who had studied theater and acting. That guy was so talented. And he was also like, he was a safe driver. And I always felt very safe with him. I also experienced some realities of racial America with Jeff that I will never forget. We can talk about that in a minute. But Poetry Alive, that was a decent job to have for a young person. If you didn't have a lot of debt, you know, financially responsible, you got a salary. They paid for your lodging because you stayed in hotels each night. Each person gets a separate room. And then you would do a short residency in a school. So you do 1 to 3 performances, and then you would do 1 to 3 classroom workshops. When I was young with Poetry Alive, I was really skeptical about going into middle schools, because have you met any middle school children? They're loud. They smell funny and they're loud. And I loved it. I grew to really love it. And Rodney told me something that I never forgot. He said, once you've got a middle school kid, you've got him for life. And that always stuck in the back of my mind. And as I went on and I started doing, you know, I branched out, I started doing residencies on my own. As I later became a poetry host and event host and then professional poet in my own right, traveling around Europe and the United States on my own, after 9/11 happened, you know, I'd been doing a lot of that, and 9/11 caused a lot of us to reflect on our lives. Like, what am I doing here? And I was kind of in my late 20s. And I remember going to work at a building that I was working at after 9/11. And I said, I can't do this anymore. I am going to go be a teacher, because Poetry Alive had kind of, it whetted that appetite to be like, I think this is what I could do. And after 9/11, I did. I was in North Carolina. I went to the Winston-Salem Forsyth County Board of Education building. I put in my application and I was hired within a week. And I became a middle school teacher.
What you're talking about is how all of the work that we do influences all of the people around us.
Yes.
You know, it's interesting because the Poetry Alive seed grew out of 1981, when I first went to the National Storytelling Festival in Jonesboro, Tennessee, and saw poets on the stage and storytellers telling poems and telling stories. And then when I went back to North Carolina, back to Asheville from Jonesboro, I told Bob Falls and a bunch of people about it. And so the next year, I brought a group of people over from Asheville, and Bob was there and I was there, and we saw the same thing again. And on the way back in 1982, Bob said, well, you know, I've always wondered what it would be like to, you know, perform poems. And I was saying, you know, I'd like to become a storyteller. I wonder how you could do that. So in our conversations, and Bob and I was renting a room from Bob at the time. We said, well, you know, maybe nobody is telling poems. What if we organized a poetry telling team like Barbara Freeman and Connie Reagan Blake have for the folk tellers? Mm-hmm. What if we organized a poetry telling team and memorized poems? And I had memorized Ulysses by Alfred Lord Tennyson. And Bob said, well, if I memorize 2 poems and you memorize 1 more, we'll have 4 poems and we'll have a show. And that was in 1983. We had 4 poems. And after that, we developed a 2-hour show, which we launched in 1984, and we called it Poetry Alive. And from that 1984 show, we were hired for $400 to come to the University of South Carolina at Beaufort to perform the same 2-hour show for a literature class. The woman's name was Joan, I think, who had hired us. And so by 1986, we had booked a number of gigs around schools. And Jackie Lydon, who was an NPR correspondent, came down to Asheville to visit Ron Evans, who was a Chippewa Cree storyteller, keeper of the stories of his tribe from Canada, building an ocean-going 40-foot catamaran in Bob Falls' backyard, which also brought all the storytellers together there. And so 1984, 85, 86, 87, we were all just dramatically focused on the storytelling thing. And that's how it all rose. It rose out. And so by 1991, when I sold my share of Poetry Live to Bob Falls for $30,000, believe it or not, we had seven teams of poets on the road. And that was in 91. And 92 was when we started the Poetry Slam. So the whole thing rose out of that one visit to the National Storytelling Festival in Jonesboro, Tennessee. Had I not done that, I would have never invited Bob to come with me, and we would have never collaborated, and none of this would have happened. So I just want to acknowledge the Storytelling Festival as the actual place where it all started. So you entered in 1995.
And I entered in 1993. That was when I first started walking through the... In 93, I discovered Winston-Salem's scene. And then it was in the autumn and winter of 93, 94 that I discovered you folks in Asheville.
Right. And by that time, the momentum was fertile, and it was bringing people like you in. So the talent was coming in, and it did. And then you moved into the Poetry Alive scene for a while. And then you became a teacher, which you are still doing to this day.
I am. Yep. As I was telling you in our previous conversation, so here's all the things I've been as a teacher. I'm now on year 26, I think. I started as an eighth grade English language arts teacher, did that for years. And then when a new high school opened in my area, I was invited to join that English faculty so I could move up with the kids I was currently teaching, because they would have to go to a new high school and they really wanted to go to the old one. So I did. I ended up teaching high school English for several years and was a yearbook advisor. Then coaching has become a thing in schools in which you now have teacher leaders providing instructional coaching to teachers. I did that here for a few years. I have to be honest, I didn't love that kind of work. It took me kind of far from the kids. And so I did my postgraduate work at Duke in gifted education and have now landed the plane safely in gifted ed. And that's where I plan to stay.
Wow, that's really amazing. All the way from that tall 20-year-old redhead walking out of nowhere and hoping for it all to having succeeded. So as we close, which we have to do soon because we are at the end of our time, you and I are going to be presenting work at the upcoming Lake Eden retreat and book launch in October. You came to the Leaf Festival, the first Leaf Festival in 1995, and performed. And last year you helped MC the last Poetry Slam of the Leaf Festival, because the Leaf Festival has now closed its doors and Lake Eden is still very much alive and hosting events. So we're going to be experimenting in a laboratory setting this coming October. So I'm looking forward to that. Anything that you would like to say before we close? I wish that we had more time. Maybe I'll invite you back for a third time. This is your second time back to back. You're the only one I've ever done in the last 10 years that did a back to back show like this. So you hold the record.
Always talk to you. I will tell people this, that if you've been listening to this conversation and thinking to yourself, boy, I would like to try X big scary thing, do it. And I'll tell you why. That while my poetry trajectory has not landed me on any bestseller lists, I have won some nice poetry awards. I've published some books, et cetera, and so on. I'm a fair to middling poet. Let me tell you what poetry led me to. It's funny how the things you walk into can lead you to totally unexpected outcomes. It led me into teaching, which has given me so much joy as a career. But let me tell you what else it's done. I learned through doing Poetry Slam that I'm a really good host. And that's the talent that I learned has brought me more joy, I would say equal to or more joy than doing poetry. I now have a radio show. I'm a co-host of a live radio show where I live. And I host events throughout the state of North Carolina now. I host at music festivals. And that means stage management. It means being a responsible and caring presence for artists. I take good care of artists. We keep shows moving. If you're an event organizer and you don't have hosts, well, you got to call me, because they really do keep that show moving. They give attention to your sponsors for your event. I have enjoyed hosting as much as anything I have ever done in my life, because it allows me to be a very small cog in the wheel of the diminishing world that is our arts community. We need to take good care of our arts. And if you are a caretaker like me who can play a role like that, oh, you ought to do it. So go do the thing and find out what other thing you might be good at. Might surprise you.
Well, Kim Ling, thank you for that piece of advice to close the show. Once again, appreciate you showing up.
It's always been a pleasure.
And there you go, my friends. Thus concludes my conversation with Kim Lane. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. And on that note, thanks ever so much for tuning in to Twice 5 Miles Radio, fertile ground for conversations worth listening to and remembering. I'm your host, James Nave. Thank you to Veen Dial for managing WPVM-FM in Asheville, Robin Collier and Mike Tilley for doing the same in Taos, KCEI, Cultural Energy Radio. We have Walter Parks to thank for our theme song. Thank you, Walter. WalterParks.com. For more on Walter's music, you can always reach me, Nave@JamesNave.com. Nave is spelled N-A-V-E. And if you would ever like to join me and my creative collaborator on a Saturday morning for an hour's worth of writing and conversation, we are there on Zoom. You can go to imaginativestorm.com and find the link to that. We'd love to have you. It's an open community. And if you like to write and you want to lean into something around some of the stories you're telling, imaginativestorm.com is a good place to start. So there you go. Thanks ever so much for spending some time with me. And I do hope you come back sometime soon. And until then, I'll catch you on that turnaround somewhere down the line.
Diamond ring, my baby wants a diamond ring. I can't afford that diamond no more. My baby wants a diamond ring. My baby wants a string of pearls. My baby wants a string of pearls. Get on that track and make them dollars fast. My baby wants a string of pearls. Wants a string of pearls. Mama, that gold is gonna be mine. That gold is gonna be mine. The pistol in my hand, gonna get it where I can. That gold is gonna be mine. That gold is gonna be. Stash, I'm told. A William had a stash, I'm told. So I went to his place with my pistol and my grace. A William had a stash of gold. A William had a stash of gold.